on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is moving like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown Triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
They'll be moving the horses through the back ring and into the pavilion. And, of course, you know, for those that haven't been to OBS for any period of time, you may not recognize what's gone on here. I didn't even bring it up with Tommy because, you know, now it's pretty much complete, I think. I don't think there's many more additions to be made to the refashioned sales center, but it's fabulous. And it's very pleasant here. It's so different, Ocala, from, you know, really anywhere that we go. It's unique, and I hope that construction we kind of referred to doesn't and it doesn't get too built up here, because it feels like it's got that that potential. You know, we talk when we're in Lexington about how difficult it's been for them to balance. Okay, sweet. What about you? What do you got saying? With Ron Marquette wandering by, we can't do a morning without checking in with Marquette.
I've been running around trying to see if anybody left anything that I could afford.
Well, have you been? I haven't noticed. You signed any, or what are you doing?
No, I've got out run on a couple that was nice horses, but there's a lot of sales left, and I'm not going to overstep my comfort level just to come back with a halter full of a horse. You know,
that's fair. That's fair.
There's some really nice horses here, and there's a lot of well-meant people here that's trying to get them. So that usually makes for a robust sales session.
Which of the first 2 days, what horse that got away did you think was something you would have liked to have taken home?
All right. The people that I will applaud for getting good horses that outrun me is Hip 546, which is, if you saw that one, it was a good magic. But look, you got to remember, whenever I grade these, I grade them off of movement and workout, and then so I send them to my owners, and I'm sure my owners look at me like I've got three heads, because I didn't know what it's going to bring. I had no idea, but I write these numbers down in the back as they go.
Sure.
And then come to find out, they go, oh, yeah, you sent me to a horse that cost...
The sales topper.
Sales topper. But some of the ones weren't. I mean, the first number I wrote down this year, if you can look, is Hip 95.
Oh, that I happen to know about that horse a little bit because the Uncle Mo, because Jimmy Ventura brought that horse up.
Yeah.
First thing on Monday morning.
Now, for today... Today is I think there's a couple really nice horses. I love Hip 611. It's a Burton Jones family, and it's a Girvan, which is a little more popular right now. So you're kind of paying for an up and coming name, but what a beautiful, beautiful horse on the end of a shank, and kind of hoped it would stay in my price range. But if the rest of them. If this one acts like the rest of them that I loved, it's probably going to run way north of what I feel comfortable with.
Well, and everybody, that has been the theme the last several years. That the ones that have the page and look the best, and you bring over a good one, you're going to get paid, or you're going to have to dig into your pocket. This is interesting because this is the first foal out of the dam. The dam is by Mark Valesky.
Yeah.
So the page is not going to thrill people immediately, although I could tell you that Seth Klarman might be a candidate because obscurish pedigrees he loves. But the second dam was very productive. That Casanova Striker,
which right now Jonathan Thomas has a good one that's out of that mare, and. And, I had a horse named Upstriker that was out of that family.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I go to the fishing holes that I've caught fish.
And, there you go.
And I know that if you get a good-looking horse from a family you've had success with, then there's a possibility. You know, and as far as pages goes, Whitmore's page looked like somebody dropped a pin on it. It was just, it was wider than my legs. So we... I'm trying to make pages, not pay for them.
Well put. And I'm just looking at some other elements of this. That I mentioned that Casanova Striker. She was herself. That's a Ned Evans family.
Yeah.
And but I look down. There's Holiday Soiree by Harlan's Holiday. That screams Governor Jones.
Yeah. Well, everyone knows that Phillies seems to be what they do exceptionally well. They've won the Kentucky Oaks twice, I think, with their horses. I know Proud Spell and what was the other one?
Betty. Betty?
No, there was Wildcat Betty that won the
Great Wildcat
ones.
Betty B.
Yeah.
That was Larry Jones.
What was the other one? It was another horse recently that they won with. But anyways, I know they've won some very, they're always prominent in the fillies and mares. So I always sneak and give them a little bit more.
John?
More experience, you know, with them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the cell is pretty much like the racetrack. There's, at the top end, it's hard to win.
Exactly.
And you need to come here and you need to be patient and jump in where you feel comfortable. But it's hard to win at the top end.
Well, you've been doing it and you continue to do it. The Oaklawn season has gone well. And
look at this. I'm going to hand the baton to the man, the myth, the legend.
thank you, Ronnie. Ron Moquette, everybody, and checking in. Moquette has given us an update each of the mornings. Happy to get Sid and John Sakura together. And, boy, you know, John said, you know, later in the week, and your timing, pretty impeccable, I would say, after yesterday's $2 million good magic. Congratulations.
Well, I was hoping that would happen, so I wanted to have good news to talk about. So fortunately, it worked out.
A lot of things have worked out, John. It's been a great early season. We're about a quarter of the way into the year, and racetrack results speaking for themselves. We can touch on some of that, but you know, the sales season getting started, you know you can count on the Curlins, but when the good magics and the midnight lutes are making the top of the page, it's a good start to the sales season.
Absolutely. It really sets up for the September yearling sale and sort of precursor to things to come. So it's good that you have racetrack and sales results in your favor, and you know, it's a competitive business, and people compare and contrast different stallions and what's value and who's getting runners. And fortunately, several of our horses are doing both, succeeding in the ring and on the racetrack, more importantly.
What does this experience with Good Magic, what message does it send to breeders, you know, prospective breeders that are making decisions on stallions for their mares, whether it's commercial or whether it's breeding to race, about picking a horse that, you know, last fall, I mean, these pinhook successes, the story is that people thought, oh, well, Good Magic's not really off to a great start as a sire, so I'm not going to spend for an expensive Good Magic yearling, and then you see what's happened.
Well, I mean, people are probably in many ways irrational in that they expect immediate success. They want horses to be precocious. They want to see them in April and May, and oftentimes that's just not the aptitude of the sire. So if your expectation is different than sort of the ability of the horse or what you should expect, people probably turn off and turn on too hard. You know, we always had belief in the horse, and his three-year-olds are exciting. He's got, you know, several horses on the Derby trail, and in no way in a two-year-old year should you make any assumption on a horse as a success or failure, because it's too early. You know, any game, football, you don't decide who wins in the first quarter, you know, so you have to be patient and let it play through, and you know, Good Magic gets better every day, and Son of Curlin, you'd have that expectation. Even though he won the Breeders' Cup, you know, he was a maiden going in to Breeders' Cup in November.
That's a good point.
If you expect him early, you're probably not really paying attention to, you know, what the horse should do.
Not only that, but Hillendale also has Violence. He's got a bunch of horses on the Triple Crown Trail, headed by Forte, obviously. Army Mule, another first-year horse that's punching above its weight. So it's a, you know, it's a pretty good roster you got there right now.
Thanks. Where would you like your desk? don't forget Ghost Zapper. I mean, the old stalwart, there's some prejudice against him, and people ask me, how old is he? Doesn't matter. He's only old if he doesn't get the job done. So he's getting the job done. You know, he had a Breeders' Cup winner last year.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a remarkable sire. And so we've been fortunate that horses are going well. We have only two now last year freshman, now sophomore sires, Army Mule and Good Magic. And Army Mule's got more stakes winners than any horse in his crop. And I said, say this without critiquing, you know, he bred a lot of $5,000 mares. In fact, we did a little analysis. I asked Jared in the office, well, what did these mares make in foal? I think five of his stakes winners averaged like 8,200 carrying them. The filly that won the stake at Oaklawn, Classy Bridget, she was bought in foal carrying her for $2,000.
Oh my God.
The horse has really been remarkable in how he's moved his mares up. In fact, in our ad, we said that only Quality Road, I believe, was the only horse that had moved his mares up as well as Army Mule. So it's good. He's getting turf horses, which I guess I didn't rule that out, but I didn't have the expectation that that would naturally be something he's really good at. And, you know, the filly won the stake at Gulfstream, and there's a lot of exciting things, you know. And he was a beautiful horse, very fast, he was undefeated, and he's getting runners. So that's, you know, that's good. And, you know, Forte next weekend looks to be the horse to beat. Don't want to jinx it or talk about too much, but, you know, he's legitimate champion, won the Breeders' Cup, and I was at Gulfstream, and he was just so impressive in his debut, just the physicality and the way he matured and emerged from 2 to 3, and the way he just made a move and just ran past that field. So, you know, there are a lot of good horses. They're all like the NCAA tournament. Everybody wins in different places, and they come together, and we see who's best. But Violence is really having a great year as well.
Well, and that we go back to that weekend when Forte won the Fountain of Youth, but at the same time, Ben Colbrook sent Raise Kane out to win the Gotham. You know, you mentioned the Army Mule filly. There was also Dance Macabre. We just were talking about Kelsey Danner in the last hour, and she wins the Here Comes the Bride. And I think back to when you introduced Army Mule, and I remember asking you during a sort of a pre-season conversation, and you said, you know, try to promote Army Mule, because he's going to be a bargain and he's going to hit. And you know, you've built that reputation of finding stallions like this that people can get covers for $5,000 typically getting started, and then they just march up the ladder.
Yeah, I mean, we don't purposefully try to be unorthodox, but I think there's a lot of prejudice against horses that are unwarranted. You know,
unwarranted.
Yeah. So when we stood Candy Ride, everybody would say they thought this was an in-depth analysis. He's by Ride the Rails. Yeah, he's by Ride the Rails. But you know, Leafheart and Blushing Groomer's pedigree, and he's undefeated. He was dirt and turf and world record speed, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of people didn't pay much attention to that. And then with Army Mule, I said, everybody's going to say, he's by Frisian Fire, like nobody knew that. And I said, you know, he's by Frisian Fire, yeah? Frisian Fire was the Derby favorite. He's by AP Indy. His dad was the champion sprinter in, Australia. Like, Deputy Minister's his pedigree. There's a lot of neat things about the horse, and, you know, once you make the decision, you really can't listen to public opinion, because the only opinion that really counts is when they open the gates. How they train, how they look, how they sell, those are just temporary. But the fixture, what really judges and grades a horse, is how do they perform on the racetrack. So, you know,
it seems like that's one of your things, John. You've got a history. Let's talk about like Candy Ride. Didn't have that fashionable pedigree, but he was 6 for 6. He was speed. He might have had a lightly raced career, but you seem to be, one part of your recruitment is to get well-performed horses, no matter how brief their racing career was.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that is circumstance too, because the market is so crazy. Any horse that has a high three-year-old threshold, where he looks like a Derby horse or looks like Triple Crown horse, you know, the beginning mark of what you have to bid is double and triple what it is with an older horse or a lightly raced horse or a horse that just has the circumstance. And then the bonus structure for three-year-old races I'm not judging anybody else, but for me to go in and buy a horse for, it's $20 million, and if he wins this, and if he wins that, and you add, and you add, and you add, and he could cost $40 million, well, when you're running a, quote, business, or in the horse business is my business as well as a passion, you have to be able to offer the proper stud fee. You know, we don't like to breed 240 mares to a horse. I'm not judging anybody. I'm just saying it's hard for a horse to handle that book. At least that's been my experience at our shed trying to organize all of that. So you really have to have a mixture of right stud fee, right presentation, and giving the horse a chance to make it. And if you start too high, you wind up doing foal sharings and mare sharings and different things that I believe, at least for me, it interrupts the process, and it's not the approach I want to take, you know. And initially, Stormy Atlantic, some of those horses in Metoctin, they all had more than 100 stakes winners, and by necessity, I had to find horses that I believed had great potential that others wouldn't chase, and I avoided the big money.
How are you finding these horses?
I just go by gut instinct.
Stormy Atlantic, you brought up from Florida from Appleton, right?
Yeah. and he had one stakes winner.
Right.
At the time, and he got
Medallion d'Or. You stood for one season for his first, and that was a crop of Rachel Alexandra.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought there's certain kind of races that I think are very predictive of ability, which I just sort of keep to myself. But
Violence, you took not only because of the race record, but presumably because he was the son of Medallion d'Or.
Yeah, we sold the horse too, so he was a beautiful horse. And, you know, it's a Maple Jinsky pedigree. I remember her. What, 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah.
Dejure, and it's a.
I was just telling Steve, by the way, I've known you for like 30 odd years, and before you came here, I said you look exactly the same as you did back then.
If you could get inside my head, sometimes I don't feel the same.
Jod, a couple of notes on the roster, and there's more. Obviously, the third day here. There's going to be the yearlings coming. Give us a preview. We got the charlatans who seemingly there was tremendous demand. It felt like the weanlings last year, right? And some of the mares, we Sid and I were tracking mares in foal to him, were selling well. So it feels like Charlatan is bubbling along, ready to pop. You've gone out of your way to try to convince people to give World of Trouble a chance as well. Talk a little bit about what's coming later this year.
Yeah, Charlatan has foals this year. He bred tremendous book of mares. He breeds a tremendous book of mares this year, both in numbers and in quality. And I thought the mares that sold last year, last November in foal to him, were premiumized. So he's a horse that we haven't seen any drop in demand from year one to year two, which is sort of unusual. And I compare his stud fee based upon his race record, the way he looks, etc., as great value. It's real money. It's $50,000, but for a horse like him that's only beaten once in his life with, I think, legitimate excuse. He was brilliant, he's beautiful, he's balanced, he's by Spitestown. I think he's quite American, he's a great broodmare sire, so I think he's got all the tools. You know, World of Trouble, they're just going to have to run. And unfortunately, the stigma is something we couldn't overcome with service.
The stigma was there with Sharp Azteca too.
Yeah.
And, he overcame that.
I agree. So, it'll be the performance of the horses.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, it affects foal crop size, and foal crop size is one of the indicators. If you're a good sire, the more you have, the more you win, the more stakes winners, etc. So, he's going to have to do it the hard way, and it's. I always say in the horse business, there's a million and one ways to get beat. There's a million There's one thing that's never happened before, and it happens to you. And in that case, that happened to us. So it doesn't affect the horse.
There's another point I do want to make. You know, people understand that John has Curlin on the farm, and Curlin is obviously one of the top stallions in the country. But when he got Curlin, when he went to buy Curlin, the minority interest with Craig Burnick, Curlin was at the lowest point of his career. And so it was yet another very timely acquisition to go in, get the horse, and then that summer is when he started to take off with, like, Exaggerator at Saratoga. And so what was he thinking in that, John, that you went after a horse that was probably at the lowest point and looked like he might not do something?
Yeah, I mean, I knew Smart Strike because he was bred and raced by Samson in Canada.
Yep.
And, you know, I really wanted to get in position to buy a horse that I thought could be a classic sire. We were well ahead of the curve. I believe we overbid at the time. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was the only way that we had a chance to win that bid, and just sort of a gut feeling belief. And, you know, when you do something, I wouldn't call it reckless or impulsive, but based on a gut feeling, you've got to be all in and all in hard, and that's what we did.
Was there any thought at the time that you lost Candy Ride to Lane's End, and now you were going to be getting Curlin out of Lane's End?
No, because that wasn't even part of the bid. When I bought the interest in the horse, we were the successful bidders.
Right.
Barbara Banky had a right of first refusal, and she set that aside and let us buy the interest. But there was not a tie-in or quid pro quo, mm-hmm. quo that you buy the interest, you get the horse. That evolved over a couple of months after.
All right. So, with your relationship with her then, also we can tie in two other stallions with this lightly raised profile and the pedigree as such. One is McLean's Music with one start, got a classic winner in his first crop. The other is Cantharos, also a Banky horse, started off in Florida and then brought to your place. Was that relationship with Barbara Banky in place before you decided to go for Curlin, or was it, well, kind of a package thing to...
No, the first horse was McLean's Music.
Right.
So I have a very fond feeling about the horse, not only because I was convinced that he was going to make it and he was a brilliant racehorse, but he paved the way to further the relationship.
Right.
And, you know, then Curlin, and then Cantharos, and then Good Magic, and so everything evolved.
And of course, Banky also is Ghost Zapper as well.
Yes, right? That I dealt with Frank Stronach on that, but
right.
She gave her blessing, and you know, a very special relationship with Stone Street, really all of their people, and mm-hmm. you know, particularly.
And of course, Charlatan was Stone Street bred.
Yeah,
they were in on the horse too.
They retained their interest, and
right.
I bought the horse and syndicated the horse, and they kept their interest. So it's been a great relationship. I would say it's, you know, any ideal relationship is mutually beneficial, and I believe that we've heightened the profile of the horses, and it's been fortunate that, you know, Good Magic is possibly a sensational sire, certainly one on
now,
the horizon.
Do you have like a group of farm clients that you have the mares that you know you can put to these horses?
To a degree, but, you know, people are
not
pretty,
like
pretty
Claiborne
independent.
With the Phippses and their whole thing in the old days. It's not like that, is it?
No,
you
I
have
mean,
to hustle for them.
I make suggestions, but
yeah.
If you buy the right horse and you stand up at the right price, and they come to see him, they're physically impressive. You know, there's varying degrees of interest. A horse like McLean's Music, you're telling a story that a lot of people didn't want to hear or didn't believe in. You know, so then you send your own mares, and, you know, we bred Cloud Computing in his first crop, won the Preakness, and after that you just sort of stand out of the way, and here comes Jackie's Warrior, and
yeah.
You know, he's
drained the clock.
He's not only initially they were winning, and then they looked like, oh, they could be fast. They started winning Grade One races. He won a classic race, and then you got everybody's attention. At that point, then it's really remote control. You know, then you're on to sort of I don't like the word hustle. That's you're on to driving the next horse and, you know, building his book and setting up a foundation for success or failure for them. And, you know, I
got a question for him.
Yeah.
So anyway, he and I were at the same party last night, which is Craig's
Boyle.
Crawfish Boyle. Boyle. Anyway, that's the first time I'd seen him there. We chit-chatted for a second. But I noticed when I was there, and I ended up talking to this, and it just kind of dawned on me for the first time, there's all these second-generation guys now that are there, like Price Bell, Gatewood Bell, Brett Jones, you know, a whole...
Will Farish.
Yeah, all new...
Third.
A newer... group of young guys, which, you know, you kind of know, but when you see them all in one place and you start talking. And then I'd actually been in Kentucky at a restaurant, and John's son was there. And so the lead-in is, are your sons kind of primed to carry on like a lot of these other guys?
I mean, those are individual decisions for them. My mantra to the boys is, if you like it, you can't be in it. You have to love it.
Yeah.
If you like it, you're going to fail. There's zero pressure to enter the business. There's zero pressure to try to sort of up your dad or continue along. But I believe my eldest son, Jess, has a real passion for it.
And that's who I met.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a hard worker. He works at Frank and Dino's.
Right.
At night, he goes to school. He worked for Todd Pletcher 2 summers, and including the April meet, and, you know, working 16, 17 hours a day. And he sold a lot of seasons for me this year.
You did?
Yeah, just on the telephone.
Wow.
Funny story. We went to Del Mar maybe a couple months ago. I'm sorry, San Anita. And I went out, he goes, Dad, I'm going to be a little late. Where are you going? And he came back, and he sold like 8 seasons, $400,000 worth of seasons.
How does he do that?
In the bar. He's got a great personality. He's passionate. I sent him to Australia. I gave him $500, airline ticket, 3 phone numbers. Say good luck. I'll see you in a week. And he's talking to all those people now. And he hung out with Gay Waterhouse. And great with him. So he has that.
Yeah, you know,
that's great.
When I was at Frank and Dino's, I was actually having dinner with Francis, who works for our company. And this kid comes over, and I said, you got to be Chauncey Kerr's son.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's been a remarkable experience for him, because I tell him, forget, doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter how much money you make, just be present. So in the summer, he worked for Todd, got to meet Mike Rapoli and Steve Young, and
right.
I'm close with Vinny, and you know, like a guy like Vinny is obviously he's a brilliant man and so observant, and you know, he called me and he said, your son doesn't have to work, but he gets up in the morning and works. That's how you're going to make it, you know. And then my middle son, he's away, he goes to the University of Richmond, and he's a great student, brilliant, he's on a roll, and just an exceptional student, and he likes it, but I think he's sort of at a formative age now where you're 18, 19 years old. You don't know what your life's going to be, you know.
Yeah.
So he's going to get a real degree, accounting, business, whatever. Jess is going to get a degree.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be psychology, sociology, or communications. I told him, you're not allowed to fail. You can drop out, but if you're in, you just had to come back with a piece of paper.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my middle son is just turned 17. He's a very good hockey player. He's playing
with your last son.
Yeah, my youngest.
Your middle son. Yeah, so
yeah.
Your middle
so
son's
the
at
middle,
Richmond.
Middle son's Richmond.
Yeah.
He's a great student. He's a very good athlete. He had some hip issues, so he had to stop playing hockey. He was a very good lacrosse player, won state championship, MVP, etc. And I don't know if he'll get a chance to play in college or not. And my youngest son is a very good hockey player. He will play in the national championship in San Jose next Wednesday.
Oh, nice.
First game. So he left home at 14 to go to this academy. And you know, he went to the national team camp for the best 100 players in the nation.
Is that the junior
year.
League?
He's just in high school now.
Oh, right.
But,
yeah.
You know, things move fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tell them you have to have a passion, you have to have a work ethic, you have to have a commitment that guarantees nothing. But without that, you're guaranteed to fail. So, you know, I was very independent, continue to be so. So I want my kids to be the same way. And if I were honest, yeah, I would love to see one or more continue in the business. I don't think there's room for all three in the same place, and I've told them that. So, you know, you can live in Chicago and be an attorney and have a racing partnership and go to the races and love it and have other job as well. So, you know, it's up to them what they want to do. I just insist that they work and they earn it and they're respectful of people and they're never arrogant or think they're somebody other than competing like the rest of us have, you know.
And, that's John Secura with us from Hill and Dale, and speaking of Dale, Dale Romans is going to join us too, and I'm going to stay here because, John, because I want going to do a follow-up question that can transition into Dale's visit, which is kind of an industry overview, I count on you as kind of a North Star for having a feel as to where we're headed and how the HISA portion of implementation and what you're hearing from clients and associates and what your impressions are as this thing takes root next week.
Yeah. Well, I think anytime there's change, people are resistant to change, no matter what it is. And anytime you implement something that's never been done before and it's supposed to be sort of pervasive through the entire industry, there's going to be some rules that you really can't implement. It's unfair to horsemen, doesn't make sense. And then as long as there's an open-mindedness where you just keep trying until you get it right, I think that whether we want it or not, there's an obligation within the industry to be perceived as fair, as uniform, and that the sport is played above board for everybody. Maybe I'm in the minority, but I think a lot of the critique is against the business is unjustified. I think that for the vast majority, horsemen are honest. They want to do everything they can to win, except cheat. But if one person cheats, it's sensationalized. It's in the paper for 2 years, and those that either don't like the sport or have some way of looking at it nostalgically, they think it has to be run a certain way. And some of the biggest critics of our industry are within it. You know, I think I have a saying that whatever game you play, the game is bigger than anybody. So, you know, like Dale's had a successful career. Very successful, but if you don't put the game above everybody, every game is that way. And I think there needs to be more respect internally for the game than sort of fighting your battles publicly that degrade the game. Everything changes over time. I don't have to deal with a lot of the HISA stuff. My office, any horse we have in training, fill it out. But I understand that's a burden to people, and hopefully, the intention is, as I stated earlier, to have a game that people believe in, to have rules that can be enforced, that are fair, that are equitable, and don't put such a burden on trainers that a small guy with 10 horses can no longer be in the game. You know, so if it's a pure motive and intention, I think there'll be a lot of changes. But in the end, we need a business that's enforceable. Nobody can argue that California has one rule, Kentucky has another, horsemen in charge of that. Any legitimate sport has a uniform rule, and in the NFL it's four downs, it's not three downs in this, so I think uniformity, and we have a different public today, like it's terrible if a horse would break down or something will go wrong. You feel it as an owner or a trainer or a fan, a sadness, but we'd never have 300 people protesting. Horse took a funny step, and they had to put the horse down. Ban racing and chanting, and they're like, people think that steaks come from the clouds. cows are butchered. That's how you eat a steak. And social media, and so I think there's a lot of agenda out there, and I won't say too much about society today, other than some of the norms that we had growing up with. Today I don't identify with people that Like they think they're a cat or a dog, and that's taught in school, and that seems like I've said something extreme, but it's pretty much in the norm. So when it comes to animals and sport and competing, I think that there's a different standard of acceptance. And you know, these young people, they're going to be our next fans. They're going to be our next owners.
Hopefully.
And we have to appeal to them in a way that the purity and the essence of the sport attracts them. But then they feel good about the way the sport is run, and they can tell their friends, and their friends are excited, not repulsed, about the fact that you're involved. And that might seem extreme, but we saw the circus. You've seen PETA. You've seen Greyhound Racing. You have to be very sensitive to the opposition. I think there's a hard line. There's some people you can't deal with or negotiate with, but there's probably sort of some fringe people that way. If you could educate them, they understand. Like I'm. It sounds like I'm off topic. I don't think I am in this, but I'm a Falconer, so people have said to me, oh, that's cruel. You take a bird, you're captive, and you do these things. And I said, well, do you know anything about falconry? No, not really. So here's what happens. 3 or 4 juvenile birds in the wild die. So this bird I'm carrying in my fist, she's probably would have been dead. They live to hunt. I take her, I hunt. She's in a safe hawk house. She's fed all summer. I take her to hunt, and there's no restriction. At any time, she can fly off and say bye. And I go, you know what? I've changed my complete impression of that bird. I can pet her, and she welcomes the relationships. A lot of people with racing, they see something go wrong, they go to somebody's barn, and they see horses are poulticed, they're walked, the vet come, and at the farm, they live in better environment than most people. And, we really work hard to, intervene and stop any problems and care for the horses and, neonatal medicine. And we do a lot of things to, for the safety of the horse and for the health of the horse. And I think a lot of people don't know how hard it is and how much effort we make to really care for our animals. And if something goes wrong, it's devastating. Forget the economics, just the emotional bond of that horse that you've named, you've raised, and you plan a race, and your groom loves the horse. All those things are, so we're committed to the animal. Yes, it's a sport. Yes, it's a competition. But I think that everything we have is because of the horse, and I think that all of us are proud of that fact, and always remember that the lifestyle we have, if we weren't in this business, it might be a lot different. And we owe everything to the horse.
Yeah,
it's the oldest sport in America, and we're first time ever we're trying to make drastic change. So a lot of people are going to push against it, and we're going to get a lot of things wrong in the process of the change. We just have to be able to recognize it and correct the mistakes and get everybody on the same page. It's a little bit radical right now. I think it'll all settle down, personally. But you're right. We got to protect the sport. The biggest thing we need to do right now is educate people on how well the horses are taken care of and the extreme we go to make sure it's as safe as possible for them. So, it'll settle down over time. You can't expect to turn a major ship very fast. It takes a while.
16 miles, yes. For those that don't know.
Exactly. So now we're trying to change the oldest sport in America overnight, basically, and it'll take a while. But there's good people doing it. I think Lisa's the right person running the ship right now. She's done a great job. She's listened to the horseman side. She's listened to every side. And she makes an independent decision about what she thinks is right. And so far, she's impressed me.
How difficult are you anticipating? And I know you've kind of been a convert on this topic, but how irksome or odious do you expect the changeover to be? How much interruption?
It's difficult for me, and it's probably difficult for anybody that's been doing this a certain way for 30 years to up and change. But the generations coming behind us won't know any different. It'll be easy for them. And you turn over generations in this game pretty fast. There aren't that many that are around 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, we were just talking about the generation thing right before you came.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when the people come behind us, they're not going to know any different. They're going to think it's crazy that we didn't have a federal organization from day one. I can remember the days when guys galloped without helmets. Now if you told somebody to go out there without a helmet or a flak vest on to protect themselves, they'd think you were crazy. But we've always made incremental small changes as we needed to, but as time goes faster and faster, the world starts doing things quicker and quicker. It's taking a while. Give it time. you know, whether I wanted federation legislation or not, it's here. So quit fighting against it. Let's start fighting together and try to make it right. And if change doesn't work, one thing about Lisa I've seen with her, if some, she doesn't get her heels in the ground on much. And if she sees something's not working out, she changes it and tries to fix it and make it right and workable for the horse and the horseman. But like I say, like John says, the best thing we can do is educate the public on how well these horses are taken care of. And catastrophic injury is our major problem in the game. But if you look at statistics, there's just as much catastrophic injury with horses in the wild or horses that are pets that are out in fields. At least we have people right there to take care of the problem immediately.
Well, and you know, the equine injury database report came out for the year, and you know, lowest ever. And so the attentiveness and the technologies being applied, you know, the safety nets, the you know, the stop gap kind of testings that, you know, or examinations. You know, I know that there's been some incidents where you know, horses have not been allowed to run, that you know, that there's no way to know if they would have been fine, but it you know, it creates a stir. It's problematic for racing offices, racing departments, owners. You know, there was the Joe Sharp horse sent out to run in the big cap that seemingly was fine and wasn't allowed to run. You got an owner that, you know, put a horse on a plane to send out there, and so there's problems that arise that have to be smoothed over or explained and made palatable to stakeholders.
Sure it is, but here's the thing, everybody, now you're saying like I've converted and I've changed and I'm pro-HISA all the way. Whether I am or not, it's here.
Right.
And what I've done, decided is it's here. Why keep fighting against it? We got to work with it and try to mold it in the right way that works for horsemen and horses. But one thing about the game, we need to, nobody listening to this radio show is, or in the crowd we're talking
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
It's other people. We need to educate them on how well these horses are treated. And that everybody in this game puts the horse first. And the problem with the big cap was, that was a problem with the horse going out there. But I've got a theory in my barn. I tell all my jockeys, if you don't like one field, scratch it in post-parade.
Right.
Because I'd rather us be wrong with a horse back at the barn we can work on than one laying on the racetrack.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And you're never 100% right. So let's always take the conservative route. And I think that's what the game's turned to. We've gotten much more conservative on the horses that we allow to race. And the way that we handle them and the way they inspect them ahead of time. I think all those things have been good. And the things we're fighting over with HISA, in the big picture, they aren't that big a deal. And we'll all get on the same page. And if everybody has the same rules, then, you know, who can complain? We're all playing the same level playing field.
Fair enough.
Well, I think one of the
Go ahead.
I think one
Sorry.
Of the things, Dale, that everybody, like John said, everybody wants uniformity. They want, obviously, the best for the horses. It's a changing demographic that's coming up, and you got to have sensitivity to newer societal feels for animals. But the big issue that a lot of people had with this out there, and the impression that it's being funded and controlled by a controlling body whose agenda is not the same as general horsemen. You're a part of the general horsemen, and you've now endorsed it, right?
Well, I haven't endorsed HISA as a whole. What I've decided to do is start working with them and try to get, because we fought so long, nobody on our side was involved in any of the conversations, and we got steamrolled, and it went through Washington. We tried to stop it. We couldn't. It's here. So it's time to, you know, put our differences aside and try to work together to make going forward as good as it possibly can be.
That's good. That's good to do, but never lose sight of the fact that one part of this industry that controls this business put this thing into effect. They put it into effect with heavy lobbying and a lot of money, and they are the people that are funding it at the top, because this thing is not being funded yet. It's being funded by loans from people at the top. So when you have your competitor funding something that's going to affect you, there's always suspicion.
Sure, there's always suspicion. It's the jockey club. But
well, you said it.
And
I didn't want to say
I'm going to say who it is. The jockey club versus HBK, and I'm an HBK man all the way.
Yeah.
But I also am smart enough to realize when I've lost, so I better jump in and try to make it as good as possible.
I appreciate the fact that you're trying to work from within now and actually advocate for the stuff we're talking about.
Exactly. And Lisa, I will say this about her. She has never once, if she didn't answer the phone, she's called me back within 5 minutes. And I'll complain, and she'll listen. And she's already made a lot of major changes against things that we didn't like going in, and she sat down and listened to what we said, and she proved to me that she's willing to listen and willing to make change when things aren't going the right way or it doesn't really work. A lot of things look good on paper, but they don't work practically. Yeah. And I have found her to be a breath of fresh air in the industry.
As she seems to be super nice.
And I think that she's aggravated the jockey club along the way. She hasn't placated to every single thing that they want.
Nope.
And until I met her, I wouldn't have thought there's somebody we can work with and that we can help mold it. But there's no reason to keep having inner fighting. It's federal law, and it's going forward. Let the lawsuits keep going. And if they ever kick it out, believe me, I'll jump back on the other side. But while it's federal law, I'm going to work hard to try to make it as good for horsemen and horses as possible.
I appreciate that angle. You know,
I think you're both really kind of saying the same thing to a degree, in that I'd be on both sides. I have suspicion about is there an agenda involved in HISA? Do they want to have certain trainers excluded? Do they want to mandate some things that they think the business should be, and it should be expressed in that way, and we'll use a sort of third party to mold and change things? At the same time, we've had, 30 years to stop arguing amongst ourselves and come up with a, quote, solution. We've never been able to do it.
John, 30 years. It's been 200 years the horse people have been arguing back and forth. And we're not going to stop arguing just because there's a federal board here. There'll always be an argument when you compete for a living. But here's a question I have, and then I got to go back and buy a grade one winner. Why in the world does the jockey club have to pay for the defense in court of the federal government's bill?
Well, that's the big issue, because normally when you have federal legislation, USADA, for example, is actually funded by Congress. They get money.
Right.
What's odd here is that you have this thing put out, and the government is not funding it.
If the funding was there,
Ed Martin from RCI was screaming, if you're going to adjust this, then get us $8 million or whatever.
We need $80 million
year. The four of us, John, you, me, and Steve, are hanging around the table, and Steve comes up with this plan, right? And he says, we can't get any money, but I'm going to fund it. He's going to fund it. Now, if he's funding for all of us, we're going to wonder,
What's in it for him?
Yeah, is he putting his people? I mean, what's going on? It's not the way things are done in this country.
No. Mitch McConnell only backed a bill, they say, if federal money wasn't involved. But listen, it's a $60 to $80 billion economic impact on the United States government. It costs the federal government about $80 million to fund it annually, and 99.9% of the problems will go away. We can work all the rural situations out. The funding is the issue. Anybody has a congressman out there, get on the phone and call them and tell them we need some federal funding.
Quick impression of some horses out here, and an update on Cyclone Mischief.
There's always good groups out here. There's some great horses. This is the first 2 year old, so I've been to it 5 years. I haven't been here since they rebuilt the building, but I figured it's time to show back up, and we haven't got anything yet because the good ones are bringing a lot of money, but we'll keep swinging. And Cyclone's doing great. He's working Saturday, pointing to the Florida Derby. Let's take on the champion one more time.
Well, I will see you there, and good luck to
save
rest
a little
of the
more
way.
Time for me. I got a lot to say.
All right,
see you guys.
Good luck with Cyclone Mischief.
Thank you, fellas.
Dale Romans, everybody, and always a pleasure. Dale, come take a picture with this group here. Might as well here. Stand up, boys, and we'll get everybody together. And there we go. Let me get this person sort of out of the picture. There we go. Beautiful. Outstanding. John Sakura with us. Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. John, any of those fun partners, you had the nice success with the mayor and with any runners out there under the banner?
Which banner? I'm sorry.
You had the Hockey Buddies.
Oh yeah, no, we're back in action with COVID and sort of had an interruption. A few fillies retired, and we have four fillies to train this year, two justified, one's a Tappet, and a Candy Ride. So four very well bred, handpicked fillies. They're at Eddie Woods. I saw them here training well. They're, you know, by the right sires. They're well bred and they look the part. So we're
have some fun.
To this date, we're undefeated. So we'll see what happens.
Josie, Carol?
Yeah, they'll probably go to Woodbine, I would think, yeah.
Well, we're going to be doing another season with Woodbine coming up. And, in fact, we didn't talk about it. I had a conversation last week with Tim Lawson. I understand that the hotel and casino that was I'm not going to recognize Woodbine next
really year. I know there's a development plan. I didn't know if they're
supposed to be unbelievable.
It's underway, and I read that they just signed a new deal with the Horsemen. There was a little controversy there. And again, off topic maybe, but it goes back to my point. I didn't get to finish this.
Oh yeah,
Dale gets excited.
please finish this.
Yeah, I was saying for the past. Okay, so since the beginning of racing, people have argued, but nobody has talked about a commissioner, a uniformity of rules, etc., with any veracity until the last 30, 40 years, maybe 20 years. It's just there's too many stakeholders, and anytime everybody has a little bit of power, there's a vacuum of control, and everybody has their own little piece. So this federal legislation, whether it should be HISA, whether people behind it should be the people behind it, all those things are within individual opinion. But nobody, I believe, can argue that a real sport shouldn't have some centralization, shouldn't have uniform set of rules. The NBA, every league has somebody that has an independence as well as listening to their stakeholders. And, you know, I always joke that everybody wants a commissioner as long as you can pick who it is, you know. And, you know, this, I just hope that it's independent. I hope that there's not an agenda that is, you know, discussed amongst 10 people in a room smoking a cigar, and the business is going to look
back
different.
Room.
Yeah.
Backroom dealing.
As long as, you know, it's above board and up front, whether you have a reluctance or not, I think in some form or fashion, we do need to show the public that, you know, we're centralized, the horses are taken care of, there's a set of rules, there's, you know, the JRA is the most successful racing outfit in the world, and everything is highly regulated, and you know it, but in regulation there's always somebody that says, why do we do this, why do we do that, I don't think that's reasonable. You know, I think you can work through all those things unless there's not an orthodoxy of opinion where somebody's going to say, for example, no medication of any kind whatsoever, that's the way racing should be. Well, then you've got a lot of horses maybe can't compete. Maybe a lot of horses, if they bleed once, they'll never run again. You know, it could be, if it's extremist, it could be very alarming and dangerous for the sport. So I think that skepticism and following things along and really doing your due diligence, you know, as Sid has done, I think that's really important, because, you know, anybody left alone, whoever accedes to power never gives up power. So you have to challenge, you have to have things above board. And when you know something that's not right or that caters to a few and is going to dictate to many, you have to challenge that. And, you know,
that's the ultimate.
That's exactly
thing.
What.
Yeah. That's the ultimate point of anyone. Nobody here is arguing about a centralized sport, the care of horses, uniformity, that's all positive stuff.
Yeah.
But the problem is you can't couch some of these other things behind that.
Yeah.
100%. What you just said.
Yeah. I think we're all in agreement to a degree. Dale is as well. So I think you should be skeptical. You should be worrisome. I mean, if you look at the history of, you know, government and as control tightens amongst the few, you know, power can be corrosive and disruptive. So unregulated power gets concentrated, and you know, then
that's
it becomes
about one
a
of the
dictator.
Best things I've heard. Yeah. That's about one of the best things I've heard from a horse person.
I got to ask this because I've brought it up a few times, John. The support of Heisa from the breeding community, given the potential for contraction of the sport, where does the breeding community that's so gung-ho, who do they think is going to buy these horses and support the rosters of stallions? I mean, there's a critical... The threat... We're already having a steady reduction in the foal crop size. We should be trying to attract more people to the sport from the breeding side. And yet... We're seems like we're opening the door to a smaller business overall, and I just don't understand that concept. There's a critical mass that's necessary here, is there not?
Absolutely, and listen, breeders are aware of that, but the reality of most people in everyday life, particularly in what we do, where horsemen. You're at the barn, you're foaling mares, you're breeding mares, you're getting ready for the sale. The demands, everyday demands of life within most farms, are you're totally consumed with the utility of your task and the next challenge, the next deadline. Government intervention, these rules are, they're not something that there's a lot, there are not a lot of horsemen that have got together and say, let's discuss this. This was really thrust upon us from
higher up.
groups and you know, and it was politically manipulated and explained to one side, here's what we needed, and it's that, without judgment, that it wasn't quote a vote of the people, it wasn't a consortium of the 10 leading breeders or stallion farm owners that said, we're going to, you know, let's discuss this, here's our concerns. So there was, they might feel there's representation, and the other side would say, well, all you had to do is write an opinion, or you could have come to a meeting, or, you know, the guy's got a mare to foal, or he's, you know, like going to a meeting. How many people go to local meetings? But, you know, we recognize that foal crops are essential. You know, California has 5 horse fields and, you know, integrated stakes, and, you know, Bob has 3. That's nothing against Bob. He's got the best horses, and he runs them. And, you know, so it's up for the other owners to be buying horses, supplementing fields so that you know, he can compete in 8-horse field. But the economics of the business, I believe that's the primary challenge, because, you know, we have slot supplementation of purses, and I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent, you could be talking about 4 hours, but like when I look every year at the graded stakes committee, when they take grade one races away from California, it's like, guys, what are you doing? They don't have the ability to supplement their purses, so the winners always are really good horse, but they don't have 5-6 deep like you do in New York, because you run for $1 million, you run for 300, where are the horses going to go? So I think they're unfairly and harshly judged. I don't like to see grade one races disappear, like somehow the purity of the competition dictates whether a race is really a grade one or not, and we change it, and we add it, and we subtract it, and we upgrade. You know, I know people would say that's naive, because, we're in a different day and time. And, the Pennsylvania Derby will be a grade one because of slot money and, you know, deeper fields of horses. But, you know, I don't know how you grow the handle and how you get purses to a level where, you know, in some jurisdictions you can get guys to buy horses. So, you know, it's easy enough to produce a horse. It's a lot harder to buy a horse. So, you know, it's demand. That's why you have such polarization of the market. You know, you don't have, you know, a lot of people from Parks or Penn National buying the $30,000 yearlings because their owners doesn't make sense enough purse to make it go. So horses follow the money, and anyone that doubts it, look at Ellis Park before and after slots. Look at Turfway before and after. Look at Dueling Grounds, now Kentucky
yep.
Grounds. You'd rather run in Saratoga, but you'll go wherever the purses are. And, you know, you can also say that, you know, those within the industry, some of our stakeholders, I mean, racetracks are essentially controlled by two companies. And, you know, I've been critical before. I think they're great business people, Churchill. I'm not going to say anything too controversial. So do they love racing? Do they care about racing? Is highest and best use of property, is that priority one, or is perpetuation of racing priority one? Well, without answering the question, I think you could point to Hollywood Park, Calder, Arlington, highest and best use. And, you know, that's, again, another challenging dilemma. Like, you know, Santa Anita, that parking lot's worth a lot of money, and, you know, what generates more? So the business is really, I think it's got away from, quote, horsemen and horse people over the last 30 years to where, you know, Laurel, someone owns a racetrack, and he goes there and he says the food's got to be good. You know, the beer can't be $14. We need good races. And, you know, that's different than a corporate spreadsheet to say, let's change to Pepsi instead of Coke because we can save 5 cents, you know. And, you know, there's definitely, so this consolidation, you know, it's, again, multifaceted. But look at the stakeholders. So if you pointed to Churchill Downs, you can't run at Arlington, you can't run at Calder, can't run at, Hollywood Park, because they don't exist. So, therefore, you don't need as many horses. You know, there's a lot of complexities.
There are, and that's a really good point, to your question that you answered about that, HISA, in its own way, is leaning to more consolidation mm-hmm. because it's trimming the game, and the stakeholders on the breeding side, it's really meant for the most expensive horses, you know.
Yeah.
What's really going to happen is the smaller horses. The horse you start off like Candy Ride, for example, or those are the horses that'll suffer because you got plenty of owners that are in partnerships, and everything's in a partnership now, and there's lots of money at the top. And if you just look at the way the game is right now, it's a game at the top, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you know, I say this in my office, that those horses that we started with, you can't stand a horse in Kentucky today for $10,000.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Unless you create 80 breeding rights and profit protect. I don't know I wouldn't call them gimmicks, but all the benefits you get. So if you have a horse like that, you better breed 40 mares of your own, and the owner better believe in the horse and do the same. And if they run, in 5 years, people will support you. But there's not, they don't do that anymore. I mean, Gervin looks like a really good
start. And that trend is getting more acute.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He used to do the odd one. He started in Florida. Accomplished horse, and looks like a really important good sire, but I mean, they didn't even try to stand him here, you know. I don't complain because the market is what the market is, but I think there's a lot of challenges, and I don't know how you properly prioritize the challenges and how you address them. For me, the primary one is purse structure, and, you know, if you don't have supplemental gaming, you don't have sports wagering, you don't have those things to boost your purses, I would love to see California find some way to raise their purses 50%. And, you know, been talked about for a long time, but, you know, there's the man right there, Bob Baffert. He would tell you the biggest challenge that, you know, when the Indians needed our help, we ignored them.
Well, we did worse.
Now, well, we need their help. They're ignoring us. They don't need it. So, you know, it's retribution in its purest form. But, you know, the bookends of the business, New York, California, we need a strong California. We need open racing. I understand state racing is important to locals, but you start leaning too much on state-bred program, it's going to sweepstakes for bad horses, not specific to California, anywhere, Woodbine, New York,
etc. Even that's going to go away because smaller guys aren't going to be able to exist.
Yeah.
That's the challenge. Yeah. And California has the added difficulty of being literally an island. I mean, it's just far. I mean, we talked with Gary Fenton yesterday from TOC. That was one of the three hats with him yesterday. The Ship and Win has been a big success, and it's bringing some people out, but there's also a steady exodus heading in the other direction.
Yeah, but that's an artificial inducement.
Yeah.
It's for a meet. You come and run once, we give you $1,000. That's not economic stability foundation to own a bunch of horses. You know, I'm not knocking the program. It's good.
Yeah.
It's a tomorrow, today's solution. We need a tomorrow, next month, next year solution. And believe me, if the purses are right, you get full fields of horses.
That'll solve a lot of problems.
You ever think an undulating course in Kentucky Downs, you're going to have people ship from all over America?
$1 million races there.
Yep. Look, if you're Kentucky bred, you're running maiden 160,000.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
What's your impression about this heavy turf bias that's taking place in this country?
As far as riding races for turf horses?
Yeah, it seems like more than 50% of, for example, Keeneland's spring meet, more than 50% of the stakes races are on turf.
Really? I don't know if they're catering to the horse population that's coming or why they do that.
Turf racing gets bigger fields.
Yeah, and it's exciting.
Yeah.
And you win by a head.
I mean, you get bigger fields.
All I know about turf racing is I can't stand a turf sire. I've tried it.
I know.
It doesn't work. So Kitten's Joy made it, but he'd already made it before he came.
Yeah.
So, most turf horses now are horses bought in Europe. They come over and race, and then they're sold, and they're not a domestic product.
You opened the door for me to ask about Lost Treasure.
Again, tough. They're turf horse, and, we sold a nice colt here yesterday, and he's going to have to make it on his own. Not a huge following. I think there's people that they just don't get it. I'm not saying they don't get it. They're not understanding it. It's just not their interest level. And a horse like him, I thought would work 5 years earlier. It would have worked. I think we could have bred 75, 80 mares. Today, that's a tough proposition. So he's got 2-year-olds. They're going to have to run. That's it. So you have smaller crop, smaller support, and you have to immediately overwhelm people and exceed expectations.
I got a question for you too. We're talking about how expensive stallion prospects are. Well, now of course it's like the stallion deals are being done at the yearling and 2-year-old sales. The syndicates start. The bigger the partnerships now, Wildcat for different colts. You got 10 guys, 7, 6, 5, 10 guys on a horse. So basically you're starting to look at the stallion prospects before as yearlings, basically.
Yeah, I think the necessity of that is how expensive these horses are. It's crazy how expensive 3-year-old prospects are for stallion farms, and then the bonuses are so comprehensive. They every achievement you could recognize, think about, is an extra payment. And buyers are smart in that they want to have one of those horses to sell into the market, and the best way to do it is pull their resources.
Also, the track record of these horses, like Justify partnership, Your Horse Charlatan partnership, Authentic partnership, it shows that these guys can wildcat horses cheap, relatively cheap, a million or less or whatever, and then if they pan out, they got the stallion right there.
Yeah, I think the debate is the cause and effect. Does three guys joining a group, do they buy three expensive horses, or they buy one horse and money's out of the market versus extra money in the market? But in a free market economy, you do whatever you think makes sense. I think syndicates are are good for the business, particularly if they succeed, mm-hmm. because you can be a guy that has a very superficial knowledge. You can write a check. You're a wealthy individual.
Flight Line is the biggest example of
you can enjoy the winner, so you didn't have to look at the horse, vet the horse, etc. So it has the possibility of introducing, I think, more money into the business. And again, you know, just like HISA, whether you like it or not, that's a reality. And you know, you see Eclipse and you see people doing great jobs that are spending more and more money, getting higher red feather and higher profile. I think that's great for the game. You know, anytime there's a critical mass where more people are affected and benefited by involvement in an industry, I think the more influence you have in the body politic, the more interest you have, newspaper, media, etc. You know, when if you know someone that owns a horse, we go to the races, and my cousin, my this, you know, if you'd asked some of the, you know, whatever they are, 1 or 2 or 5% owners of so-and-so, in fact, this has happened where, you know, people have told me, oh, you know, a friend of mine, whatever, he owned Audible. He's part of a group. He's, you know, so that's good, you know.
Yeah.
So the only day we really have where everybody watches and thinks about the business is the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, if we can, you know, the My Racehorse, get more people involved, I think it's great for the game. But I think it's economics. I mean, I was, again, not trying to pick on anyone, point out, but I looked at Kentucky Oaks is $1,250,000 purse. It's got to be a $3 million race. The Derby must be a $5 million race by any metric. Who watches, the handle it generates, the profit it generates, how it's a driver for the economy of our business. How
is it not?
You know, and a million of the $3 million is yours. Is your own money. It's $50,000 to start, plus 20, that's $2 million, plus whatever. Then you got to buy tickets. And like, you go to Dubai for $12 million, and, you know, it's our sport, our business, and even, I've said that for years. In fact, I think the Derby was about $2 million to a few years ago. And,
You actually hinted at that a few years ago, that there was a push going on. There was even a high level push industry wide to get the number up.
And I say that it's not selfish, because you know, unfortunately we breed and sell. We don't keep any colts, and we're not running in the Derby. But that, you know, wealthy people, they want the ultimate prize, and everybody's watching, and the eyes are upon you. Yeah, you could argue if it was half people would still come, but I think there's certain events that are drivers of the industry.
Yeah,
and don't specifically look at that. That is
the engine.
Yeah. That's the Academy Awards, and everybody's there, and the glamour, and the glitz, and the red carpet. Now let's have a lottery of money too, you know, and how that's funded or how it's contributed, it sounds like I'm knocking Churchill. I'm really trying not to, but I would argue that based on any metric you want to look at it, the Kentucky Derby is underfunded and the Oaks is underfunded, based on its relevance and importance of the industry and the money it generates for everybody. And, you know, when you're a participant in revenue generation, you should be a equitable participant. You know, if you sell 10 million records, if you fill a stadium at Adele, the ticket price indicates what you pay hers based upon the event, and that's a unique event. There's no event like it in our sports. The closest thing we have to a Super Bowl.
It's the Super Bowl.
Yeah, everybody should be rewarded.
Breeders' Cup is for the players. It's a horse player event, and an industry event. It doesn't, no matter how it's been marketed, it just has not, it has not captured the imagination that I think John Gaines, John Nehrud were hoping for. You know,
it's an industry event.
It is.
It's another topic of conversation, because I believe that we could do way better in trying to make it a world global event. But I think
Would you be, would have you, you've been on the board. Have you been on the Breeders' Cup board?
I have been, yeah, but I'm not so, on now.
Currently. Yeah. Would you advocate for it being run outside of the United States?
I would, you know, when they opened Medan, I said I would have tried to race in Dubai, and I believe Sheikh Mohammed would have funded the entire cart. He would have put $30 million in your pocket and an exposure to the world. I think there's limits on where you can go and where you should go, because it's a, you know, it's pretty much it's an American event to a degree, but I think we have the ability to attract a global audience of participation, both, you know, Japan, South America, etc. And I had an idea that didn't go anywhere, but I said I think the goal of the Breeders' Cup should be the World Cup of soccer, and I evidenced the how I thought handle could be generated by one starter in the ARC generated $40 million of handle in Japan. So if you had all the countries in the world betting into your pools, and you had a race for Southern Hemisphere, and you had a third world country race, and a Southern Hemisphere race, I think you'd bet billions with a B on the Breeders' Cup. And I don't know why you wouldn't do it. And you'd have fans from Panama and Venezuela and New Zealand and Argentina and Japan. And you could really make it an international event. But I think the view is we like the way we're doing it, or it's manageable, or I'm not sure. But I don't think the maybe the initial goal or the founding goal was to be a global event, but I don't think the follow-through or the vision today is to be anything other than, you know, winning, you're in, a few horses come from Europe, and, you know, I'm not trying to critique, but if I think there's a bigger vision out there if it was embraced.
Interesting. That's an interesting topic. I've heard it floated. I haven't seen it lately, but it was maybe about 5 years ago. Well, when Satish, whenever Satish is involved, there's outside-the-box thinking.
I think Keeneland's a great place for the Breeders' Cup. I read the, you know, record handle, et cetera. And, you know, you're going to sort of a place of comfort where the whole community embraces and understands the sport and their fans, and they go to Keeneland. And so I think all those things are really good. You'd like to go to an event where, you know, if you're going to go to a the rodeo, you want to go in Oklahoma or somewhere where everybody loves it, and you know you don't want to be able to buy boxes in the parking lot for half price like some unnamed places would be.
It'll be nice to get the event back to New York.
Absolutely, and you know that's a great thing. They're going to spend what $500 billion or something there.
At least 500 million.
500 million.
I'll take the over.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But you know, it's all said,
it's refurbished, and it's all about customer experience.
Yeah.
And you know, you
needs it. We all love Belmont. I see people going berserk about destroying Belmont. I'm sorry. It's
a dinosaur. Yeah.
It's just too big. Mm-hmm. It's too old. It's not heated. It's not going to serve the future.
Yeah, and the politics, you know, they gave up, from all I read and understood, a real good legal challenge to being the owner of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's pushback on the money. And, like, you know, if I'm all in, I would have challenged that I own it or I'm not. But if I owned it, you'd be like...
Are you on the jockey club or not?
I was momentarily. I'm no longer on the jockey.
You're no longer in the jockey club?
No.
Are you on any boards?
I'm on no board.
Okay.
I'm on no board.
All right, well, in that case, since you said that to me, I'm taking all your comments a little better.
John, fabulous.
I'm not part of any Hill and Dale board, that's it.
The ultimate iconoclastic individual, and just invaluable always to have a business like this.
I really believe you have to have a purity of thought. You have to have your own opinion, and in certain environments, that's either not welcoming or it's disruptive. So it's unfair if you have strong opinions that are against the majority,
right,
or the perceived protocol of the organization to be there, because then you're sort of a hindrance, you know.
Well, that thinking has brought Hillendale a vision, Alapa, and you know what you've crafted. I can't wait. In fact, 2 weeks we'll be in town for Bluegrass Week, and I'm going to finally get out to see the farm. I can't wait.
Great. Look forward to having you.
Well, we always look forward to conversations with John Secura, Hillendale, and I do see our friend Joe Vellante mentioning his son Christian, the Legion Bloodstock Group. They've got, he's now telling me, they've got a World of Trouble that is an absolute runner, and he just bought another one for $50,000 minutes ago.
Great. I hope you have him on next year as a Derby horse.
I love it. Sid Fernando, thank you.
As always, it was great.
Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. A fun morning with Sid and John. Dale Roman stopped by. Moquette stopped by. We met Tony Raylo and Crown's Way Racing. We talked to the Ventura brothers, Jimmy and Tommy, for the first time together ever. And Dick Powell, we did some Hong Kong. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Back here at OBS tomorrow. Talk to you then.
All right, bye.
It's At The Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts breeding program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third.